Greetings, Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, we've got several movies to talk about, some of them in wide release, some of them in limited release, some on demand. Sort of a pickings for everybody out there. We're going to be talking about Need for Speed, The Single Moms Club, Veronica Mars, and The Art of the Steal. We're also going to have some news. We're going to talk about the trailer park. It's going to be your last chance to win the Blu-ray that we were giving away last weekend. And, of course, we're going to have the world-famous DVD roundup. If you want to reach me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave a voicemail at 740-205-6456. And you can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and on facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. If you want to find me personally and give me your opinion on anything about myself and my view of movies, you can go to twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. We're moving into the news. This actually isn't news. I just want to kind of bring up this one thing. I normally don't cover television nearly as much as I do movies, but I have to give a big shout out to the folks at Fox and Seth MacFarlane and Neil deGrasse Tyson for their reboot of Cosmos, which is a fantastic series. Just started last week. You can, it's a mini series. You can watch it again this week on Sunday nights. And it's also going to be shown on the National Geographic channel. I remember watching Cosmos with Carl Sagan back in the 70s with my father. And my father was a scientist, and he really appreciated science education. It was a fascinating series when it was aired on PBS. This is a fascinating series to watch now. It really helps bring the enormity of science to the everyday viewer, and it supports science education, which we need more of. I mean, we really need to have strong science base as we move into the future. So Cosmos, fantastic show. Neil deGrasse Tyson did a fantastic job, and I'm definitely looking forward to more of what they've got to offer. The next piece of news is a casting news that I wanted to point out. Jason Sudeikis has landed the role of Fletch in Fletch 1. Now, if you don't remember Fletch from the 80s, this was originally a book series, very popular book series. And Chevy Chase played Fletch in both Fletch and Fletch Lives. It was two movies. And a lot of people adored his portrayal of Fletch. It's probably one of his most revered performances in the comedy genre. And they were going to reboot this, 10, 15 years ago. And it was supposed to have Kevin Smith involved. And it was going to have Jason Lee as Fletch. And it was going to be Fletch 1. Well, that's finally kind of gone away. And now Jason Sudeikis got it. I can't say whether I think that's a good idea or not. I'm not a huge Jason Sudeikis fan. I think he's done some funny stuff. He's also done some really terrible things. So I think a lot of it depends on how he's directed and how he presents himself. I mean, obviously in a movie like Horrible Bosses, he was fantastic. In a movie like Hall Pass, he was excruciating. So I'm still up in the air. Jury's out on this. I don't know if that's going to work. The last thing I want to talk about, again, this isn't really news, more or less opinion on things that I'm seeing happening. There is a trend, a disturbing trend, at least for myself. I mean, disturbing. I mean, not in a Pakistani earthquake sort of way. Not in a, you know, this is not disturbing in a genocidal way. This is just disturbing for a movie guy like myself. The Amazing Spider-Man marketing is bothering me because I've always been a fan of seeing movies as clean as possible. I don't tend to watch as many trailers as some people do. I like to go in not knowing. And in fact, I've made a point to not know things about certain movies. A couple years ago, when The Avengers came out, I didn't watch any ads for it. I didn't watch trailers, didn't watch any ads, didn't read any news stories. Saw The Avengers, loved it, thought it was a fantastic movie, and one of my favorites of the year. Then I didn't watch any trailers for Prometheus, and although I was still a little bit behind in watching the show, figuring out everything that it was about, because they kind of don't bury the lead in the trailers, it was neat to watch Prometheus unfold and not know anything about it. I tried the same thing with Star Trek Into Darkness last year. It was a little bit disappointing, but I blame the movie for that more than I blame the process. The Amazing Spider-Man 2 is rife with spoilers. And this isn't even a complaint about all the villains that are in it, which it seems to be overbloated with villains, which is what they did with the Batman movies back in the 80s and 90s. Well, the 90s. there is, and I'm not going to say what the spoiler is because I don't believe in spoilers. I think you should be able to market your movie and you should be able to add this information without spoilers. But there is a key spoiler that is being teased in the marketing. I've seen posters that tease it. Apparently the soundtrack's probably going to have a title cut that gives a spoiler in the title, like what happened in, if you look at the soundtrack for The Phantom Menace, one of the tracks was Qui-Gon Jinn Dies, or The Death of Qui-Gon Jinn. Well, if you got the soundtrack, you suddenly looked at it and be like, oh, well, okay, that's not going to be a surprise when that happens. What's making it even worse is the arrogance of the people reporting it, because it is something that happened in the Spider-Man comics. And so people who know the Spider-Man universe, the Marvel universe of the comics, this is not a spoiler to them. But most people don't. Most people don't read the Spider-Man comics, and the Spider-Man movies are made for a greater audience. So just because it's existing material does not mean it's okay to spoil it for people. So stop putting this crap in headlines and stop putting and reporting on this stuff, because it's inconsiderate to the people who don't know the Spider-Man story. And what you're going to end up with is a movie that's not going to be as shocking or powerful with things that happen because things have been spoiled already. My thing is you should be able to make a movie, market a movie, report on a movie, talk about a movie without spoiling it. This is not reality TV. This is not The Bachelor. This is entertainment that costs hundreds of millions of dollars to do. Try and make it something that people can enjoy without knowing everything that's going to happen going in. So this isn't just shaming Sony. This is also shaming my colleagues in the press who report on this stuff and make headlines about the spoiler just because you know what happens. And the people who don't read the comics, tough beans to them, and that's not fair. Well, that music means it's time for us to roll into the trailer park. A couple of trailers I want to highlight today. The first one came out very late last week. And didn't get it on the show, but I really wanted to point it out now. It is Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. I'm going to talk about it in a second, but let's just take a listen.
Just another Saturday night.
Power is a fragile thing.
It's tearing me up how much I love you.
Dwight, is that you?
What I got to do.
She owns me.
She was an angel.
When she wishes it, we die.
One of these days, she'll pull the trigger.
Good game.
When Sin City, the first one, came out in 2005, it made my top 10 list of the year. I loved that movie. I thought it was innovative. I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was artistic. It was one of the best comic book adaptations of a film I'd ever seen. And Robert Rodriguez, very much like Zack Snyder did with Watchmen, played plenty of reverence to the source material. And it looks like, at least from this trailer, that they're doing the same thing here. Robert Rodriguez is going back to the design. He's going back to the format. He's going back to the structure that made the first Sin City great. Here's what worries me. It's been 10 years almost since the first Sin City came out. And Robert Rodriguez has had a rocky road since then. Not ice cream. He's had just a rocky career. He also has a real problem with sequels. The first Spy Kids movie was really cute. The second one was kind of cool. By the time he got to the third and fourth one, these things were terrible. Same thing he did. Machete, the first Machete was okay. The second Machete Kills, was terrible. So I'm a little bit worried about Dame to Kill For, simply because I think Robert Rodriguez is one of those first-time out directors, and when his head gets too big and he has too much control, it doesn't result in a good product all the time. But Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, comes out August 22nd. The next one I want to highlight is one kind of like flew under my radar so far. Comes out in July. It is Delivers from Evil, a new horror movie by Scott Derrickson, who directed Sinister.
There's two types of evil in this life, Officer Sarge. Secondary evil, the evil that men do. And primary evil, which is something else entirely.
I've seen some horrible things. Nothing that can't be explained by human nature.
Then you haven't seen true evil.
Not much to say about this, but it looks creepy as heck. And I thought Scott Derrickson, even though I wasn't a huge fan of The Exorcism of Emily Rose, I loved Sinister. I'm looking forward to see what he does in a new ghost story. This looks creepy. This looks clever. Opens July 2nd. We'll be talking about it later this summer. With that, I got to go to a break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about The Art of the Steal and The Single Moms Club. with Fat Guys at the Movies, now that I've gotten some of my ranting out of the way and some eagerness for some new movies with the Trailer Park, let's move on into the movie review segments, where we're going to be talking about some of the movies that are new this week. The first one I want to start with is a smaller movie. It actually has been out on demand for a while, which, by the way, may I say that that's for the smaller distribution companies like Radius, sometimes the Weinstein Company, sometimes Magnolia, IFC. A lot of these smaller companies allowing these movies to come on video on demand before they hit limited release. I personally think that's a great way of doing it. It makes it more accessible to me. And for somebody who sees anywhere from, you know, 1 to 5 movies a week on average, it's nice to not have to trudge to a theater every single time. As much as I love the theater experience, it's sometimes nice to just be able to watch a movie at home. And I get spoiled during award season because I get all those award screeners. And now I can get spoiled through the rest of the year by seeing some of the limited release stuff. Also, when you live in a place like Columbus, Ohio, which is where I live, sometimes the releases don't get here very quickly. And it gives me a chance to actually see the movie when it's being released, generally in the limited format in some smaller markets. So the first one I want to talk about is The Art of the Steal. An art thief, double-crossed and left in a Polish prison, gets released and helps mastermind one final score.
You wanted to know when I was ready to go back to work. Well, I'm ready.
First thing you need is an idea man, an Arsniki, my half-brother. Now there's Patty McCarthy. He's the guy who knows any guy you need to know. And Guy de Cornet is our forger.
Okay, great, we're all here.
They all just happen to converge in the city where Crunch lives? Sir, I'm telling you, it's happening.
This is the one we're all going to be remembered for.
The greatest outlift in history.
This is one of those smaller releases. It originally was in VOD, and now it is releasing in some theaters, limited, in probably about 50 theaters around the country this weekend. It stars Kurt Russell. He plays the art thief gone into prison. Jerry Baruchel is in there. You've got Matt Dillon playing Kurt Russell's brother who double-crossed him, and Ken Walsh playing another guy in the team. This movie is trying, I mean really trying at times, to be another Ocean's 11 movie. And I'm a sucker for heist movies. I love a good heist movie. I have a lot of fun watching it. I even remember watching a Laverne and Shirley episode once that involved a heist where they plan it out and they flash forward to the events of what's supposed to happen and then they have to go through it. So I love that kind of stuff. I'm a sucker for that kind of entertainment. And they do that a lot through this movie. And of course, obviously, the most well-known heist movies that use that sort of technique are the Ocean 11, Ocean 12, Ocean 13. Not the original one with Frank Sinatra, but the remakes that Steven Soderbergh did, and then, of course, the sequels to that. It's kind of like a heist movie, but also has a little bit of Smoke and Aces to it as well. It has a feeling of Smoke and Aces, where it's sort of this, at times, humorous crime thriller, and with some sort of bizarre characters and some weird people involved. It's not as cohesive as it could have been because it just kind of, it doesn't quite stick the landing. And at times it just doesn't feel as sharp and as punchy as it attempts to be. And that's a shame because, like I said, it's a fun little movie. It's got a really good cast. And I think part of the problem that it runs into at times is it doesn't know how far to go with the comedy. And if you actually watch the ending credits, they throw in some bloopers at the end or some alternative takes and line-o-ramas, and you get the sense you're like, oh yeah, they really didn't know how far to go in the comedy end of this. And I think they just didn't have that quite nailed down yet. So it's a bit half-baked, but still, it's a lot of fun. Kurt Russell is always fun to watch on screen. He does a great job. Matt Dillon's very funny. And Jay Baruchel does a decent job. You also have Terrence Stamp, who does a great turn as a sort of a white collar, sort of like the TV show White Collar, you know, a guy with an ankle bracelet helping out the police. So ultimately, The Art of the Steal, it's worth checking out. If you see it in the theater nearby you, go check it out over some other movies that are out this weekend. Or check it out on VOD. It's like $10 to rent. Because it's a theatrical release. But still, you know, gather the family together and it's $10. It's cheaper than going to the theater. I'm going to say that The Art of the Steal kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, and let's move on to, yes, you guessed it, Tyler Perry is out with another winner. Tyler Perry presents Tyler Perry's The Single Moms Club, a diverse group of single mothers gathered together to support each other during their trying times.
All of your children were found spray painting graffiti. You'll have to work together as a group to chair this year's fundraiser.
Girl, she need a Valium.
Should we exchange numbers, ladies?
I just didn't expect my life to turn out like this.
If people only knew what single moms go through.
I just want to feel equal.
We should start a support group.
Yeah, a toast to the Single Moms Club.
Yes. Yes.
I kid. I mean, I'm making fun of Tyler Perry. And yes, his name does appear 4 times in the credits before the movie even gets going. But this is not a Madea movie, so he's not running around in drag and he's not acting obnoxious. This is not, don't mistake anything I'm going to say here for me. Don't misinterpret me saying that this movie is good. It's not. It's not a good movie, but it's not as bad as his last couple efforts, like A Madea Christmas or Temptations and Confessions of a Marriage Counselor. Those were just god awful. Those were just painful. This is not an excruciating experience. It's more or less a boring experience. It's a very half-baked kind of, I guess Art of the Steel was half-baked, but it was still fun. This one, It's these vignette stories of these 5 different women that really don't cohesively hold together as a plot when you mash all 5 of them together. I don't know if this was originally a play, which a lot of his movies are originally stage plays. I could see this work better as a stage play because you can get away with more of that vignette structure. But ultimately, this movie is just, it's just kind of boring. The acting's terrible. And for the most part, and there's decent actors in it. You got like Amy Smart, who's not a bad actor, yet she stinks. And I think part of it's the editing. It's a very clunkily edited. It's like he's pausing for laughs that he thinks he's going to get. And I saw it. I happened to see it in an empty theater because they didn't screen it for press. Ironically, I then went and paid $10 to go see it. And it was pretty much a private screening because nobody else was there. So in the theater with nobody, these weird pauses where I think Perry's expecting a laugh just come off as awkwardly edited. A lot of the actors, they don't know how to organically deliver lines. And they don't really have any chemistry together. There's one person in this movie who does a great job acting is Nia Long. I mean, she really throws down for this part. And I've pitied her because it's such a throwaway, forgettable movie, yet she's really acting her guts out. I mean, she really raises the level of Tyler Perry's script to make it watchable, but everybody else is just sort of slumming it through the movie. The only other person in the movie that's actually entertaining is Terry Crews, plays one of, as this guy who's trying to get with one of the mothers. And Terry Crews is always funny. Unfortunately, he only shows up like every half hour or 45 minutes. So you kind of have to slag through the rest of the movie. But I mean, it deals with some realistic issues and some things that real people, real women who are single mothers will face. But for a movie that has parental nomenclature in the title, it's amazingly poorly written for the kids. The kids are terribly characterized. They're sort of just set dressing, and the relationship between the moms and the kids is so poorly executed. It's full of cliches, and it's just bad. So while it's not as bad as his other ones, it still sucks.
It sucks.
All right, with that, I need to go to a break. When I come back, we're going to be talking Need for Speed and Veronica Mars.
So sexy it hurts.
Fat Guys of the Movies keeps rolling on with the movie reviews for you. I'm Kevin Carr, your chubby, illustrious host. You know, I had a, this is just an offhand thing. I didn't wear a shirt at all earlier today. I didn't wear a shirt. For some reason, I just didn't wear a shirt. I had the most productive day today not wearing a shirt than I've ever had in my entire life, I think. So watch out, world. If it means I get more stuff done because I don't wear a shirt, people are going to be able to drink in my hairy, chubby chest whenever they want to. So if you see me at a movie, I may be shirtless. You know, hey, no shirt, no shoes, no show. I don't see a sign like that, so you better watch out. Warning to all around me within smelling distance. Anyways, let's talk about a couple more movies to review. The first one is Need for Speed. After being released from prison for a crime he didn't commit, a car enthusiast joins an illegal street race to beat his brother's killer.
I spent 2 years thinking about one moment. He set me up. He just left him there. That's what I can't forgive.
What are you thinking, Toby?
This could put him away for life. It's time we make him pay. But first, we're gonna need a fast car.
Y'all ready?
We're doing this.
When I first heard of this movie, I remember chuckling and thinking, in my mind's eye, I picture executives at DreamWorks watching the Fast and Furious franchise just tear up the box office, make billions of dollars, and they look at each other and go, we need a Fast and Furious movie. What should we do? Well, we can't do Fast and Furious because they already have a movie. So let's find something else. So they went to the most ridiculously unprofitable source for source material in Hollywood, video games. For those who don't know, very few video games actually are made into successful films. For every Tomb Raider, there's a dozen other Doom and other crap, or Tomb Raider 2. There's a lot of video games that do not translate. Here's why video games don't translate to movies. Video games are video games, movies are movies. Movies have plot and character, and they need to have a story. Video games need a setup. And while there are some video games that have a story attached to them, the story does nothing but take you from world to world to world, from board to board to board, to get through these challenges. There's not the character development you see in a movie. And even a highly developed characters in a video game, generally in terms of a single player game like this, they don't translate well. And a great example is the Resident Evil movies. If you saw the last Resident Evil movies, it played like a video game. They just needed to go from this room to this room to this room, and they had to fight zombies. And there was no story to it. That's the problem with Need for Speed. There really isn't a good story to it. Let me just get it out of the way first. The cars are awesome. The car crashes are amazing. The stunts are brilliant. When there is no dialogue and no character, the movie's amazing. It has some incredible action sequences, and it looks beautiful. The problem is it runs over 2 hours, and it stars Aaron Paul, who I'm sure was fine in Breaking Bad on television. I didn't watch it, but I've heard nothing but great things about Aaron Paul in Breaking Bad. And I've heard nothing but great things about Breaking Bad. So much so that I want to start cooking meth in my garage just to get my own television show. Breaking Fat, maybe. Well, let's put a pin in that. We'll come back to it later. Aaron Paul is out of his depth horribly in this movie. He's not Vin Diesel. He's not Paul Walker. He's not even Lucas Black from Tokyo Drift. I don't even want to make a comparison to Tyrese Gibson. He's about as un-Tyrese Gibson as you can possibly be. He tries to be a bad dude in this. He tries to be mean, but he's about 4.5 feet tall. He looks like a hobbit trying to be a badass. And that does not work. So Aaron Paul, I don't know if you're going to make that leap to movie star. You look like you walked out of the WB. You didn't look like you walked out of Breaking Bad. He's a big problem in the movie, but the other problem is just there's no story. The story's really stupid. And it's long-winded, and it just takes forever. There's no reason this movie, just because the Fast and Furious movies have clocked in at over like 2 hours, 2.5, 2 hours, 15 minutes, does not mean that you're allowed to do it on this movie. This is the beginning of franchise. Fast 5 and Fast and Furious 6, these were longer movies, and they could do that. They could get away with that. This does not have the team assembled, and it doesn't have the original parts that you need for a movie like this. Imogene Poots is beautiful, and she's wonderful in the movie. She's fine in the movie, but there's just nothing there. It looks cool. If it was 40 minutes of car chases, I think it would have been a great movie. It would have been fantastic. It's not. With that, I say the Need for Speed kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. We're going to move on to the next film, which is Veronica Mars. 10 years after leaving Neptune, California, teenage detective turned law student Veronica Mars comes back to her hometown to solve another murder.
local authorities have ruled the death a homicide and are focusing their investigation on her boyfriend, Logan Eccles.
I need your help, Veronica.
I don't really do that anymore.
Veronica, this is the whole case file. How'd you get this?
I'm sure you know breaking and entering is a felony.
Come on, I knew the felonies before I knew the state capitals.
So, are you gonna ask if I did it?
I wouldn't be here if I thought you did.
America thinks he's guilty, and that's good enough for me.
I know Logan has his qualities, but there's a darkness to that kid.
I never watched Veronica Mars back when it was on TV. I did binge watch about a season and a half on Amazon Prime leading up to the movie because all three seasons are on Amazon Prime. And I figured I want to get a little bit of background before I saw this movie. The movie itself is kind of has a great history because it started out as a Kickstarter campaign and it raised like $5.5 million through Kickstarter to get this movie off the ground. And of course, you know, Warner Brothers came in and funded the rest. But that showed real fan support. The reason that's groundbreaking, and for all the foibles and problems that are associated with a Kickstarter campaign with that much money, what this did is it proved that you can have a fan-driven movie, and you can make it. Now, we'll see how it does in the box office, but the bottom line is they already got part of their funds from the Kickstarter campaign. And they're also doing an interesting release with this. It's going on demand. It's the first major release from a major studio that's going on demand as well as in theaters. It's in most AMC theaters. But you can also rent it at home for like, what, $10 or whatever. And of course, the people who contributed to Kickstarter, they're going to end up getting a DVD of it anyways because that came with the package. Veronica Mars is a movie that perfectly walks the tightrope between fan service and getting a new audience. If you've never watched an episode of Veronica Mars, you can watch this movie and figure it out. It has a, you know, a good, oh gosh, it must be 5-minute introduction that explains everything, that kind of recaps everything that happened on TV. Because even though the TV show has its own characters and it had 3 years of story, it wasn't exactly lost. It was something you know, it's a girl. She kind of got alienated by friends and there are these bad things that happened to her and there are these murders. She was a private investigator's daughter, so she started doing investigations herself. It's easy to figure this one out. So you're not left in the cold. A new viewer is not going to walk in just completely clueless, which is a danger when you have a fan show. That's one of the problems with Serenity. For everybody who loved Firefly, when they made the movie Serenity, if you didn't come in with the pre-existing knowledge of these characters, Serenity, A, made very little sense, and B, had no emotional impact when anything happened to the characters because they were just side roles. And in Serenity, I remember watching Serenity and then this character dies and I'm sitting next to a friend of mine who's a huge fan of the show and she's just weeping. She's in tears. And I'm like, oh, he was just the pilot. They do a good job setting up what Veronica Mars is. So somebody who's never seen it can understand. And you got a neat little whodunit in the middle of it. But it also completely services the fans. Almost at times shamelessly. I mean, that even has a reference to Kickstarter at the beginning, which is kind of, that's a cheap shot. And if you're a fan of the show, you're going to love every minute. You're going to eat this up like me at the chocolate fountain or a candy bar at a wedding. You know, I don't get invited to weddings anymore because I dive in the chocolate fountain and I stuff candy up my nose and in every orifice that I can possibly cram it into my body. This is how much you're going to love Veronica Mars if you're a fan of the show. It services what you wanted to see. It gives you wrap up. It gives you continuing stories. It tells what this character did and that character did. And it has inside jokes and there's a whole scene in the middle, which if you're not a fan, you can go to the bathroom during the scene. Whole scene in the middle where it's probably about a 5-6 minute scene. Nothing but a curtain call of all these people who were in the series. And that's good because that's the people who started this movie. Without these people, this movie would not exist. And so they serviced them. And that's a good thing. But they also made it completely relatable and understandable to somebody who's never watched the show. So it's a triumph in a lot of ways. And I wish it great success because I'd like to see more of this kind of stuff happen. So with that, Veronica Mars, it rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
All right, I need to go to a break. We got one more segment. We're going to be talking about box office, more movie news, the Blu-ray giveaway, and the DVD roundup. Kevin, Kevin Carr here with Fat Guys at the Movies, rolling on into the final segment. We've got a couple more things to talk about, a really crowded final segment to just wrap things up for you this week, and then send you on your merry way, and you go check out some of the movies we talked about. First thing, let's talk about the box office. Who won, and was I correct? I originally predicted $40 million for Mr. Peabody and Sherman. I actually wasn't that far off. 300 Rise of the Empire actually won the weekend with $45 million. That's a pretty good number. And Mr. Peabody and Sherman came in with 32. So it was a little bit less for an early March release. These numbers are not bad. And a friend of mine, Scott Mendelson, who writes for Forbes, did a story about this. There are people out there that are painting these as massive failures. They're painting these as bombs before they even get into their second week. And they're not. Here's the problem with Hollywood and the reporting that goes on in Hollywood is a bomb has to be a bomb. It has to fail. Now, a movie can be a disappointment, but that means it doesn't live up to expectations. I don't think anyone was expecting 300, Rise of an Empire, to even come close to the 70-some million dollars that the first one did 7 years ago. First of all, it's been 7 years. Second of all, this has become kind of a trite filmmaking concept. And third of all, it's like the 18th Sword and Sandal movie we have had this year. Yeah, it had a 3D bump. Yeah, it had an IMAX bump. But $45 million for a big budget movie in March is not bad. I wasn't expecting much more than this. If anyone was seriously expecting a $70 million haul from this film, you're freaking insane. This was not going to happen. And on Mr. Peabody and Sherman, yes, it's not a huge success like, say, The Lorax or even The Croods was, but $32 million is not bad for a kids movie that's coming off of competition from The Lego Movie and still Frozen, which comes out on Blu-ray next week. $32 million for Mr. Peabody and Sherman is fine, on top of the fact that nowadays just the domestic total doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you make in the U.S. It matters what you make worldwide, because the money's the green no matter where it comes from. And when it comes to 300 and Mr. Peabody and Sherman, these things are going to do crazy good overseas. They're going to make money. And I'm with Scott Mendelson in calling shenanigans on somebody who calls these movies a bomb when they're probably going to end up being profitable. There was an article that said that DreamWorks was taking a write-off on this, but I don't think they are. That's fancy accounting. If all you did was take the American box office, yeah, the North American box office is not the best, but it's going to do fine overseas. Then you have all the ancillary markets. To call something a bomb that didn't make ridiculous amounts of money, what are we setting the benchmark for? Does every movie have to make $500 to $1 billion? No. So let's call a spade a spade. The rest of the top 10 is just very standard, basically a repeat from last week. The Grand Budapest Hotel came in 17th. We're going to be talking about this next week. It came in 17th with 811,000, which is a huge number. It's like over 200,000 per screen. One of the best per screens averages ever. Other than that, it seems relatively standard for the box office. Next, I want to remind everybody, we're in the last stretches of our Blu-ray giveaway. Ancient Aliens Season 5, Volume 2. We are giving away the Blu-ray of that. It's 10 episodes of the series. And if you want to have a chance, we're going to take submissions up until the midnight on Sunday, which is the 17th. I'm enjoying the responses I'm already getting, but you have to email fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com with the term aliens in the subject line and tell me your favorite alien from TV or movie and why. Creativity counts. The contest is open to only residents of the continental United States, and I must receive all entries by midnight Eastern Time, March 17th. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. A couple things I want to hit on the news catch-up. First of all, I'm attending a event this weekend. It's the 31st annual 24-hour Ohio Science Fiction Marathon. Now, it takes place at the Drexel Theater in Columbus, Ohio. If you're not from Columbus, obviously you're not going to be able to go, but it's an important event, and it's because it's a rare event of its kind. Now, there's another 24-hour marathon that takes place in Chicago. They do a horror and a sci-fi one. There's one that takes place in Boston. There's one that takes place in Cleveland. These are important because we're losing them. And what it is you cram in a theater for 24 hours and you watch 11 or 12 movies. They're showing movies like the remastered version of Metropolis. They're showing The Hidden, The Running Man, Akira, Escape from New York, some of these on 35mm, Delicatessen, Earth versus the Flying Saucer, Repo Man, The Quiet Earth, this crazy Hong Kong movie called Inframan from the 70s. these events are being overtaken by conventions, which can bring in more people and are more of a memorabilia situation, or film festivals or ongoing fest. And while I'm a great fan of film festivals and ongoing film programs, events like these have a real appreciation, not just because they show you movies you may never see elsewhere, but you're also seeing movies they're trying to preserve 35 millimeter, which I love digital. I think digital is a fine projection system, but it's nice to have venues that can still show 35 millimeter because there's a lot of archive prints out there that are worth seeing, and watching something on film is a little bit different, and there's a certain love to it. Plus, the event like this shows all these trailers and shorts. So if you ever have a chance to go to one of these events, either in Columbus or Cleveland or Boston or Chicago, take a chance to go see it, because they're amazing and fun and they have a lot of spirit. And that's what movie loving is about. It's not here to critically assess things. It's just to sit in a theater with 300 of your closest friends and watch movies for 24 hours. That's really it on the news. That really wasn't a news story. There wasn't a whole lot of like hard news. We'll talk a little bit more stuff next week, but we need to move on. And that means it's time for the DVD Roundup. I'm starting a new thing where I want to start to spotlight a couple older Blu-rays and DVDs that maybe didn't get the attention when I originally covered them, that maybe I just had a chance to see because it finally made its way to the top of my stack. The first one I want to point out is High Plains Drifter, which came out on Blu-ray late last year, around October of 2013. It was its 40th anniversary of the film, directed by Clint Eastwood. It was a second directorial effort, and it's a brilliant Western. It's an iconoclast hero. The guy's really not a hero, and he breaks all these taboos that the noble Western hero, the John Wayne character, would never do. And that's fine for the context of this movie. The film is about a drifter who shows up at this town, and he ends up being hired by them to stop these outlaws who are getting out of prison, and they're going to come back and seek revenge on the town. But it seems that the guy is here more as a revenge, and he's not really a hero because he does some really awful things. He straight up murders people. I mean, within 15 minutes of the opening of the movie, he rapes a woman. And that's not the movie does have a real sort of 70s sexist attitude to it, which is its biggest problem, because you look at it in a modern context and you're like, wow, that's really kind of creepy. You know, it's sort of that 70s, well, the women really like being raped, that sort of response that they have. And they'll be upset about it, but they really liked it. They do sort of frame it in that context, which makes it a little bit undesirable to watch. But the point is, there's a lot deeper meaning to this movie. And a lot of people point out Pale Rider as Clint Eastwood's symbolic Western of him being one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. But in here, he's the same thing here. There's a supernatural air to him, though, while they don't point it out, it seems like he is maybe the angel of death. He's riding this dappled horse coming in, which is indicative of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the pale horse. And he comes and he punishes the town almost in a Sodom and Gomorrah sort of way, where he ends up by allowing the town to be, because it's so wicked, it turns it on itself. And it causes problems for itself. And it has a lot of imagery. It has a lot of these weird little biblical undertones that if you can watch it as a Western and it works, but you can watch it as with a deeper meaning, and it makes it even more brilliant. So High Plains Drifter on Blu-ray looks beautiful, only has like the trailer, so there's no special features, but it's definitely worth picking up. A couple other ones to spotlight. Coming out on DVD this week, you had Inside Llewyn Davis, which is the Coen brothers' latest film about a folk singer in the 60s whose life is completely falling apart and he's trying to get his you-know-what together. It's a good movie. It's not my favorite Coen Brother movie, but it's still Coen Brothers. Even though I'm not a big music guy and I'm not big into folk music, it's really quite brilliant. There's also Out of the Furnace, which I like better than most people did. It's a movie with Christian Bale and Woody Harrelson as sort of these warring clans in the Appalachians, in the very depressed area. The Book Thief, which is okay, a little bit corny at times. I probably read better as a book about a girl trying to survive the occupation of the Nazis. And then finally, Homefront, which is written by Sylvester Stallone, starring Jason Statham as a DEA agent, trying to live a normal life, and his past comes back to haunt him and cause problems for him and his daughter. The stinker of the week is Welcome to the Jungle, a ridiculous movie starring Adam Brody and Jean-Claude Van Damme as people in a survivalist getaway that goes horribly wrong, and the movie goes horribly wrong. Anyways, that's it. We gotta go. Next week, we're going to be talking about highly anticipated movies, Divergent, The Muppets Most Wanted, and Nymphomaniac Part 1. Oh my gosh! Until then, have a fat time at the movies.